look at Solomon and what happens during the reign of Solomon, during the first part of Solomon's reign, is we see a picture of Israel at its height in the Old Testament. And what I want to do tonight is to continue to examine and see what that actually looks like. So I wonder if we could split into groups this evening of just two, three or four, not for very long. And we're going to look, there's quite a few chapters to look at in 1 Kings, and it'd be good if you could just look at a few to get them in your minds. So just however you feel comfortable, just with people around you, in twos, threes, fours, fives, whatever's easiest for you, then please do that. And we're going to look together, if the people in this part of the room could look at chapter 4 of 1 Kings, verses 1 to 20 in your groups. And then if people, I'm just trying to think how many I've got, if people in the middle could look at chapter 4, verses 21 to 34. And then if everybody else, so the back and this side here, could look at chapter 5. And there's 18 verses in chapter 5. Okay, so if you guys look at chapter 4, 1 to 20, and then chapter 4, 21 to 34, and then chapter 5, 1 to 18. Now, what we're not trying to do is we're not trying to get so deeply involved in the text that we're trying to, you know, answer all the questions and find out all the problems. We're not trying to do that. What I'd like you to do is, if this is a period in Israel's history where it was at its height, then I just want to try and see what that looks like. So what is the author, what picture really is the author trying to paint for us as we go through this passage? So try and sort of take it as the whole verses and see what's he trying to convey to us. What picture is he trying to give us as we read it? So if you can do that, if you look through, and at certain points there are little verses that help us to understand what he's trying to convey to us. So for example, we saw last week in chapter 3 and verse 28, it said, "When all Israel heard the verdict of the king, they held the king in awe, because they saw that he had wisdom from God to administer justice." And that came after Solomon had given that great judgment on who was the real mother and who was the imposter. So the author just throws these things in every now and again, these lines that remind us of where he wants us to go. Is that clear? Thanks, Dave. Poured over this in my study trying to think, is this clear or not? I ain't got a clue, so let's see how we go. So if you can look at it, verses 1 to 20, chapter 4, 21 to 34, and chapter 5. Okay, and then we'll just report back and see what you've got. Thank you. Yeah, just over this side, in chapter 4, verses 1 to 20. I wonder if someone could tell everybody else what it's about, first of all, just quickly, and then what you think it's trying to convey. And it doesn't matter if you don't get it, because I've spent days looking over commentaries to try and find the answer, so you don't have to get it in like 2 minutes. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great one for you to get, isn't it, Derek? All that order and everything in its place. Fantastic. Yeah. Excellent. That's right. I think that's what it's doing. The first part of chapter 4 is showing us how wisdom works out. Solomon's prayed for wisdom, and we see how it works out in practice. You know, it means that things are well ordered, the people are in the right place, people have got jobs. Great. Excellent. Who had middle section, verses 21 to 34? What did you... What's happening there, do you think?
Because it's an influential kingdom, the kingdom was a kingdom of peace. Other kingdoms in the past, like the Hittite Empire, was never at peace. It was at war with everyone all the time, because there were always rapacious conquering territories and so on. Solomon's kingdom was at peace, and he had powerful armed forces. He had thousands of stalls and chariots and horses and what have you, which may be the reason why it's at peace, but it's well organised, as Derek was saying. District officers, everything was organised in its place and well run. So, because God gave him insight. And finally, the last section shows about the knowledge and the fame, and therefore a huge influence on the cultures around, of the culture that Solomon and his kingdom had. And he showed about his poetry and so on. So, that poetry, people came from other places to hear his poetry, and therefore the influence was beyond just the kingdom of Israel.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And finally, the last section. Anything to you get from chapter 5? What do you see in chapter 5? What's happening there?
There's peace in the land.
Yeah, peace again. Yeah.
And it was prosperous.
Yeah.
There was a tremendous amount of forced labour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't have been very happy.
Which, what's that all about? Yeah, yeah. It's interesting what that means, isn't it? Yeah, I haven't got the answer, but it is interesting. Yeah. Anything else? Anybody else from that section? Yeah.
What's the significance of every man sitting under his own vine and fig tree?
That, well, that's... Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just one person under one vine. Yeah, it tries to convey the picture of prosperity. Basically, people are safe, people are secure, people are happy. Vines and fig trees are things that take a long time to grow. You know, if there's a war, there's sort of things that are going to be pulled up. So there's obviously a long time of peace and prosperity for the people to enjoy. So they're enjoying the presence of God in that place. Basically, I think that's what it's trying to say. Yeah, Kathy. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's one of those verses, isn't it? One of those pickup verses. So the author wants you to know that you're continuing with him through it. So he keeps saying, God gave Solomon wisdom. Okay, so we get this picture, don't we, that when Israel was at its height, it was a good place to be. It was a good place to be. You know, there was vines and fig trees, which meant blessing, which was good things. And it's interesting, when we get into the prophets, one of the things that they say is something like, I will remove your vine and fig tree. God says, in other words, this peace and prosperity that you're enjoying when you know me, when you get to the point where you're ignoring me, I'm going to take that away. Or, which is probably happening as well, is the consequences of not having God in the center is these things are going to disappear. So the way to know true happiness and true peace is by putting God in the center. And they've done that because Solomon has asked for wisdom, and that has been given to him. Okay, so we've done that with chapters 4 and 5. We get this picture. And we also see, don't we, in 1 to 20, this picture of the wisdom of Solomon as regards other nations as well. So when Hiram comes with a request, Solomon knows how to handle it. And it works out well. It's good that the kingdom is reaching out in a good way. It's making treaties with other people in a good way. It's not a case of, who are you? We don't want to have anything to do with you. We're all right, thank you. They see an opportunity to actually reach out. And this group also said, didn't they, there's people coming in. People are seeing how God is blessing these people, and they're coming in. And they want to be part of it. So that's what's going on, I think, in chapters 4 and 5. We're seeing wisdom in action. And we're seeing people blessed because of that wisdom in action. And God being at the centre of what the people of Israel are doing. And then we move on, quickly, we move on into chapter 6. And chapter 6 shows us that Solomon starts to build the temple. That's what it's about. The first 11 verses, I think it is, 11 or 12 verses, show us the exterior of the temple. And then from verse 14 onwards, we see the interior of the temple. And I mean, this place was impressive. If you look through that second half of chapter 6, at the amount of times it says gold, you know, this was overlaid with gold, and the floors were overlaid with gold, and everything was panelled with cedar. You know, you weren't allowed to see a stone. This place was particularly impressive. Now, we often don't like that, do we? We just think that's just daft, that's extravagance. But this place was displaying the glory and majesty of the one who was going to dwell there, which was God himself. It was displaying the glory and the majesty of God. And there's a reminder in the middle of chapter 6. There is a reminder, if you want to look together at verses 12, I think it is. Yeah, 12 and 13. This building work is going on. The exterior has been completed, and God arrives, and he speaks to Solomon, and he reminds him of what's really important. Because he says, as for this temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations, and keep all my commands, and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel. So in other words, the building of the temple doesn't mean that God's going to be there. Obedience to God means that he's going to be there. And they need to remember that. In other words, don't get our eyes fixed upon the building, but on what the building represents. And the building represents the presence of God. So that's going on in chapter 6. Brilliant. And then we get to chapter 7. And we see, first part, we're seeing this contrast where Solomon talks about, or it talks about Solomon's palace. And then we get into the temple furnishings where they get this one guy in, and it goes into the detail of these things that's going to be in the temple. And then we get into chapter 8 and we see the ark is brought into the temple, and we see that Solomon prays a prayer of dedication and the temple is dedicated. And these three or four chapters show us the majesty, really, of the temple, because it was the temple where God was going to dwell. And it was going to be a sign to people around it. Okay, so what I'd like us to do now is I'd like us to sing. And I'd like us to sing a song that says nothing about that, really, whatsoever. It says completely the opposite. Because when we see Israel at the height of its peak, really, in the Old Testament, and we see all this sort of glory and majesty and splendor, that's, in a sense, worldly. That's what we like to see, isn't it? Well, that's how we think it should be. That's how we think God should be. He's powerful. He's almighty. He should show himself in that way. But because of who he is, he actually chooses to reveal himself in a completely different way, doesn't he? Which is what we're thinking about at this Advent time. He comes in a baby to be born in a smelly stable because there's no room at an inn. So let's think about the difference of those two things as we sing together. If I had a book, I have got a book. As we sing together, it's a carol. It's number 539, Once in Royal David's City. And we'll miss out verses, which one is it, 3 and 4, which talk about children and things, so we'll just miss those out. I think time's getting on a little bit. Let's sing verses 1, 2, 5 and 6. Let's stand and sing. Okay, so we've looked very quickly at chapters 4, 5, 6, 7 and 8. That's not bad going, is it? I think if we were going to read them, we'd still be in the middle of it. So we'll get a rough idea, a quick sort of overview of what's going on in the book of Kings. And this is a great, I keep saying this, I know, but it's a great point in the history of Israel. It's a great part of the Bible. And it's interesting, when we think about the prophets that come later and the way that they judge the people and they try and bring the people back, it's this sort of time that they're trying to bring them back to, a time of happiness, a time of blessing, a time when if they would humble themselves before God, God would do this again. You know, they're not just saying, look, God's angry with you because you keep getting it wrong. It's not. They're not saying, you want to be happy. That's not right. That is right. It is right to want to be happy and joyful. But in the Lord, where the true happiness and true joy come from. And the rest of the Old Testament, we see they just got it wrong time and time again. And we can so often get it wrong again and again and again. If we want the things of the world and we think that happiness comes from material possessions or things that are around us, it doesn't. Not true happiness. Not true joy. It comes from knowing Jesus, doesn't it? So we see this God-given wisdom as Solomon has prayed. We're given a snippet of that God-given wisdom. And we saw it. I won't recap this. I'm going to skip part of the sermon because we've already looked at it. And then what we see is God at the center of the nation. And that's why they're enjoying this time. And it wasn't just a prosperous time that they were enjoying. They were enjoying living under God's king, under God's rule. Solomon was God's king, and he was being obedient and faithful to God. There were other successful kings in the book. There's a king called Omri who actually lived for quite a long time, and the nation enjoyed a time of prosperity under him, but the book of Kings calls him a bad king because he wasn't God's king. He wasn't humbling himself before God and doing things God's way. He was doing things his own way. But when we see that God is at the center, we see that there's a true joy and a true happiness. So we've seen that sort of summary in the middle of verse 6 where God speaks to Solomon when he's building the temple. If you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations and keep all my commandments and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father. And I will live among the Israelites and I will not abandon my people Israel. That's what God does. He reminds them that it's not about the building itself. The building represents God. Eventually, as you'll know, the building is destroyed because the people get it wrong. We'll see next week Solomon himself falls. He gets drawn away to worship idols, which is so sad, isn't it? It's so sad that we get this picture. And yet, even with all this blessing, even with God appearing to him twice, he's going to fall. But that's what happens. The people are taken off into exile. The temple is destroyed. And then by the time we get to the book of Haggai, God is saying, you know, I've brought you back. I've brought you back to the land. But all you're bothered about is your own houses. What about my house? The place where I will dwell? Nobody has really been bothered about building the temple. And we see that things move on, don't they? Because as I said, it's not about a building. Things move on. Because when Jesus comes and enters that second temple in John 2, he judges it, doesn't he? He turns up the tables and he drives out the money changers. We see that in John chapter 2. But more importantly than that, what else we see in John chapter 2 is that Jesus replaces the temple. Jesus says to them, destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. And they thought he was talking about the physical temple. And it tells us that little note the disciples remembered afterwards. He was talking about his own body. Jesus is now the temple. Jesus is the place where God dwells. Jesus is where we approach the living God. It is through the temple of Jesus, isn't it? The contact point between heaven and earth is no longer that Holy of Holies. It's no longer that special room where the high priest had to go once a year to offer the blood of bulls and goats. It's a person. It's Jesus. He becomes the temple. We approach God through Jesus. And that's not all, is it? As the Bible continues to unravel and we start to understand more and more, we find in 1 Corinthians 3 that we are the temple. We are the temple of God because God is living in us by his Spirit. 1 Corinthians 3 verse 16, Paul says, "Don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit lives in you?" Now, we need to be clear on this. We're obviously not the temple in the same way that Jesus is the temple. People don't come through us to get to God. We don't die for sin, do we? We don't make a sacrifice. Jesus has done all of that. But if the temple is the place where God makes himself known, then we are the temple. If the temple is where God dwells and uses that dwelling place to reach out, then we are the temple. That's what Paul is saying. It's no longer a building. It's the people of God themselves that have God living inside them, reaching out to other people. But what does that mean? What does that mean for us today? Does it mean that we should watch the way that we live? Well, yeah. Does it mean we should think about what we do carefully because God is there with us? Yeah. It would mean that, wouldn't it? Does it mean we should think twice when we attempted to sin because actually God is living in our body with us? Yeah, it definitely means that, doesn't it? And does it mean that God will use us and longs to work through us to reach other people? Yes. It means that as well, doesn't it? It means that God lives in us to reach out to others through us. That's why he dwells within us. Which brings us to our next point. God is reaching out through his people. And this is a theme that goes all the way through 1 Kings chapter 11. We see this desire of God to be reaching out to other nations. It's been in the Bible ever since Genesis chapter 12. God, we looked last week, didn't we? God chose Abraham to be a blessing to the nations. Not just to bless him, but so that through him, he could be a blessing to the nations. So, this middle group had chapter 4, verse 34. And we picked up on it, didn't we? It said, "Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom." Israel is doing the job that it was always supposed to do. It's being a light to the other nations. And those people are hearing about what's going on. And they're sending people. And then in chapter 8, in Solomon's prayer for the dedication of the temple, I'll pick it up in chapter 41. Chapter 8, verse 41. When Solomon prays, he says, "As for the foreigner who does not belong to your people Israel, but has come from a distant land because of your name, for men will hear of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm when he comes and prays towards this temple, then hear from heaven your dwelling place and do whatever the foreigner asks of you, so that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your own people Israel, and may know that this house I have built bears your name." And carrying on in chapter 8 and verse 60, it says, "One of the reasons for the temple is so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God and there is no other." And then we get the best example of all in chapter 10 and verses 1 to 13. Let me read that. "When the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. She said to the king, The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth you have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. And then look at what she says in verse 9. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness. And she gave the king 120 talents of gold, large quantities of spices and precious stones. Never again were so many spices brought in as those the queen of Sheba gave to Solomon. And we'll end there at the end of verse 10. So we see that Israel is being a light to the nations. I think this is just a symbol of what's happening. I don't think the queen of... Well, we know, don't we? From chapter 4, the queen of Sheba wasn't the only one to come. But the author includes this account to show us the effect that Israel was having. It was reaching out to the nations, which is what it should always have done. Should always have done. And she comes and she praises God because of what she sees. Not Solomon, but God. When we get to verse 24 of chapter 10, we see the enthusiasm of the author just spills over. He says, the whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. The whole world sought audience with Solomon. The God who dwells in us by his Spirit is a God who wants to reach out to the nations. A God who wants to use us to reach out to those around us. That's why he's called us. People can meet God when they meet us. And I don't think we realise that half the time. As we go into Sainsbury's or Tesco's or wherever we go, or we go to the market, or when we go to work, we've got God living in us, who's wanting to reach out through us to other people. People can meet us. Sorry, can meet God when they meet us. Now, I'm not saying that we are God. Obviously, we need to be careful about that point. But if the place... if the temple is the place where God dwells and meets with his people, and Jesus is the temple, and we have Jesus, and therefore we become the temple, then God is reaching out to the world through us. You see, I think we often go wrong when we think of it wrongly, and we fall, in a sense, we make the same mistake that the people of Israel made. And we know we can come back before God, and we do repent. But we often think it's about our happiness. We fall into this mindset that of thinking that becoming a Christian is about making our lives better. And it's not. And yet, paradoxically, that's exactly what it's about. It is about our happiness. It is about making our lives better. But that shouldn't be the goal. That shouldn't be the most important thing, because if that's the most important thing, we'll take some parts of the Bible and leave others. We say, well, I don't agree with that. That doesn't make me happy. Happiness comes through obeying God. Happiness comes through living in the will of God. Even if it means suffering, persecution and pain, there can be a real joy inside of us because it's about our relationship with Jesus, isn't it? That's the most important thing. Happiness is not a goal in and of itself. And yet that's what God gives when we get in the right relationship with him. And if we realize that God does these things, he wants us to be happy, he wants us to be joyful, he wants us to know him and to live under his rule, so that through that, he can reach out through us. You know, if we go into work as miserable as sin on a Monday morning, there's not many people who are going to say, where was you yesterday? I'd love to be there. Now, I'm not saying we should be happy for the sake of it. But that joy of knowing Jesus, if that's shining through in the way that we live our lives, then it attracts people. It makes people ask questions, doesn't it? Now, I know that life often is difficult. It's a struggle. Struggle to get up in the morning. And that's why we have to think about these things, and we have to think seriously. God chose this moment in history to reach out through Solomon, through Israel, to other nations. And he's chosen this moment in history to reach out through us. But often we don't realize it. We don't see that that's what it's about. We should be seeking joy and happiness and fulfillment in who he is, so that through that, God will reach out and touch others through us. Israel are at their happiest when God is at the centre, aren't they? Chapter 4 and verse 20. The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate, they drank, and they were happy. God wants us to be happy. He just doesn't want us to find that happiness in the wrong things. He wants us to find it in him and in who he is and in what he has done. And when we find it in him, he will then use us to reach out to other people.